From KBIA News in Columbia, this is Intersection, Conversations in Our Community. I'm Sarah Shariari. This week, we're talking about a book called Words Matter, Writing to Make a Difference, which is published by the University of Missouri Press. It's an anthology of journalism and essays written by MISU grads, mostly from the journalism school. There are also a bunch of presentations going on this week where students and members of the public can talk with writers about, what else, writing. There's information about those sessions at the Words Matter website. Today on our show, we'll talk with magazine journalist, Professor Emerita, and an editor of this book, Mary Kay Blakely, about how and why she took on this monumental task. We'll also talk with Lois Raimondo and Shane Epping, two extraordinary journalists who contributed their writing, and with student Ginger Hervey, who's been working on this collection since her freshman year. Just so you know, I also contributed an essay to this book, but none of us are getting paid for the book, so don't worry, I'm not lining my pockets here. Here's Mary Kay Blakely. You were my wonderful magazine writing professor when I was doing my master's here.
When you were still a baby.
I was still a baby. And you have a long and illustrious history as a journalist yourself, and now you've put together this book that is a collection of writing, almost all by people who graduated from the journalism school, certainly all MU grads. How did you get the idea to do this? It's such a tremendous project to take on.
Who knew it would take 6 years? But that was partly because I keep in touch with my students. I mean, motherhood is motherhood, but teaching is something else because you get 50 new people a year. And a lot of them, especially those who went into magazine writing as I had done, would send me clips of what they were publishing. And when I saw those clips and when I read them, I thought, this is fantastic. It has to live longer than between the two paper covers of a magazine. So when I talked to the first dozen or so and said, is this a good idea? They all said, oh, we would just love to be in an anthology with all J school graduates. It's like all people who went to the same boot camp together. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, what can we do? How can we gather these? So the first batch I talked to, I said, send me the piece that you're happiest to have written or you feel proudest of having written. And we started getting these pieces in, and they told each other and more told each other. So there was one point where we had more than 500 essays.
Wow.
That we had to sift through and choose from, and it was very difficult because they all could live longer than a magazine lived. So then we started looking at, okay, we need a variety of topics. We need to have it very balanced between men and women. We wanted to have at least as many women as men, and it's just still true that men get more bylines and more prominent. So we started sifting through them, and I put together a team. I always had a team of students I was working with, graduate students and undergraduates, and thank God I did, or I never would have gotten it done. It would have taken 12 years, not six. So the enthusiasm of the participants definitely fueled me.
So when you started to get the essays and you started to shape the book, what sort of value were you looking for the book to have? Is it a book for journalists? Is it a book for casual readers? Is it a book for classrooms? Who were you thinking is going to read this?
You know, I didn't think first about audience, but I did think about the pieces, and I thought, they all have to be timeless. They can't be dated. So this can't be a topic that nobody's going to know anything about 2 years from now. So I was looking for timeless. And then after I did that, I thought, okay, who will read it? And I thought anybody who reads magazines would be interested in reading the best of magazines. And then I started thinking, but, you know, if you're a writing teacher, whether you're in an institution like MU or the J School, or whether you're in the community teaching a community of writers, writers always love to read good writing because it makes us pay attention to what makes good writing. So I thought of it as a general reader audience first, and then I thought of it as a writing book that could be useful. So, of course, when, you know, the director of University of Missouri Press said, we need a common theme, and I thought, the only common theme we have here is it's all good writing. So let's ask each of the contributors to say, how do you write? Why is it hard? What obstacles have you encountered that you overcame, and how did you overcome it? And we got great postscripts for each essay then.
There are from very young reporters and very mature writers. There are from very short essays, very personal essays, very long investigations. Mm-hmm. So it's a real variety. Are there any that just absolutely stand out to you?
I have to say Shane Epping's essay is one that really stood out mm-hmm. for me because he was first a photographer and then a writer, and I think he's equally good at both. But when he went through the issue that he went through that he describes in this book about learning when his wife was in their first pregnancy, that she had a birth defect that was probably going to mean she wasn't going to live longer than 6 weeks. He wrote about that, and of course his feelings about it were still so raw. But he was able to capture the poignancy of that moment. And I just heard from some readers who are looking through the book now, and that essay stands out for them too. But there are a lot of essays in the book that feel that way to me. I loved Lois Romano's story too. She was talking very much about being in Afghanistan and having two cultures come together mm-hmm. and how difficult that was and how rewarding it was. And there are so many essays in the book, I could look at each one of them, because, of course, we spent a long time on each essay, and say, I'm so glad I have that in the book.
That was Mary Kay Blakely, Professor Emerita at the Missouri School of Journalism and one of the editors of the anthology Words Matter, Writing to Make a Difference, which is published by the University of Missouri Press. Next, we'll hear from Shane Epping, one of the writers Mary Kay just spoke about. His essay is called Faye's Ashes, and it's about Shane's journey with his wife after the loss of their child. So Shane, I read your story in Words Matter, and I was also reading about your comments on the profession of photography. The story that you write here is about your daughter who died right before she was born, and about a trip that you and your wife go on several months later where you scatter her ashes. And it's such a sad, painful story. How was it for you to sit down and decide to commit this to paper?
I remember the deadline was, I think, on a Saturday in the fall of 2012. And so I'm a procrastinator in general. So it's no surprise that I kind of waited until the last minute, but I mean, I really waited until I think that last day. It was a Saturday. I remember college football was on, and I kind of sat down in the morning on my laptop and started writing it really nonstop for about 12, 14 hours, something like that. And I think that I waited because it was difficult to think about and to sit down and remember the scenarios in my head that had happened and kind of laying it out from, you know, word to word. And then once I finished it, I really didn't touch it again.
It came out the way that it stands in the book.
I think so. They had contacted me about editing, and I had a fun conversation with Mary Kay late at night. I called her. She was in the J school. I mean, it was probably 11 o'clock or midnight. And she answered, and we kind of talked through the draft that I had sent and made some cuts that were definitely, you know, necessary. But I kept delaying, I think, the editing process and you know, I delayed the writing process just because I knew it was going to be difficult to articulate everything that had happened.
And after you wrote it, were you glad that you had written it?
Yeah, I was glad that I wrote it for sure. I think more so than any other reason would be just to memorialize the experience for Faye. I mean, I had pictures, but I felt like this was an opportunity to get her story out there.
One of the really interesting things in your story is that you and your wife had watched a movie about a family whose child was born, do you say trisomy?
Trisomy 18.
Trisomy 18. And you described the movie that you watched about that family as unbearably unwatchable, so agonizing that many people could not watch it. And then a few weeks later, you found out that you were going to live the same thing. Did you connect with other parents who have had that same experience, or do you expect to after the book comes out?
Yeah, I definitely connect with other parents. The piece that you're talking about that I had seen was Choosing Thomas, which was a video, kind of audio slideshow done by the Dallas Morning News. And I remember talking to a friend of mine who watched it at work. I sent him the link, and he's like, man, what are you doing sending me videos? I'm going to cry at work, because he had a son. And, you know, anybody who sees that video, I think, would just you'd think it would be unimaginable to lose a kid like what those parents did. And then, like you said, that's exactly what happened to us. In terms of identifying with other parents, one of the things I do as a photographer, I volunteer this organization called Now I Lay Me Down to Sleep. It's based out of Colorado. And when a family has an infant demise, or maybe there's an infant on child support, I'll go at the request of the parents, of course, and take photographs of the family and the infant. And I think on record I've done that almost 60 times. So there's a lot of interaction with parents who've lost children like what we did.
Why do you think it's important for people to have those pictures of their children? Some people would probably want to just get away from it, you know?
I think that's it's a really good question. And I would never encourage somebody to get photos if, you know, they weren't interested in doing that. I think it's the value of the photography is just like anything else that we experience in life. You know, we're memorializing, or we're kind of adding a tangible component to our life experience. In other words, you know, this happened, right? Or this person existed. And you'll always have those photos to prove it and reflect on or honor that person's existence. So I think that's why people do it. They want to remember and not forget that they had a child.
And how is it for you to go into those situations? I know some people who have lost their children, even adult children, and it seems like it's something that people like never come back from in a lot of ways. How is it for you to go and meet these parents who are living that experience in that moment?
I think initially it was really difficult, particularly because some of the sessions happened, you know, near the room where my wife and I had been during the delivery of Faye, or in, you know, near the room or in the room. You know, the first time I had to go photograph demise in the actual room at Boone Hospital was particularly profound. I mean, I remember sitting there and by myself, just kind of considering the magnitude of what had happened in that room and my experience, and then the experience of the people that I was photographing. As I've done it over the past almost 4 years, I would say that it's not nearly as emotional as what it was for me. With the exception of children who are on life support in the intensive care unit, those are always exceptionally difficult because they're still alive.
Yeah. And it's amazing to me that you sat down and wrote this story all at once, and that it sort of came out formed the way that it is now, because it's really perfect. It's such a perfectly put together story. It's like it must have just been living there inside of you waiting to be written.
That's what Mary Kay says. I mean, I told Mary Kay Blakely that, you know, I just kind of wrote this in one piece, and any of us who experiment with writing know that the first draft is just usually, you know, is nowhere where it needs to be. And she said, well, Shane, you didn't write that in one sitting. You know, you had been thinking about it in your head and coming up with scenarios and describing things, and then you just needed to sit down and do it. You know, I don't know. And I wasn't real convinced that it was any good in terms of a story. I just think that I felt a responsibility to at least try and write something.
That was Shane Epping, who contributed an essay to the anthology Words Matter, Writing to Make a Difference. Next, we'll hear from Lois Raimondo, a journalist who wrote about an unlikely friendship that formed while she was working in Afghanistan. So, Lois, I want to start out by asking you about this amazing friendship that you describe in your story. You're a photojournalist, you're working in Afghanistan, and you start working with a fixer who is essentially the person who helps you and orients you and who interprets for you, and he's named Masood. How did you first meet him, and how did your friendship begin?
So when you first land in Afghanistan, or when at that point in time, I choppered in from the north of the country, from Tajikistan, because that was the only way to get into Afghanistan. The Taliban controlled all the borders. You land in the middle of a deserted, rough mountain patch, and a series of people on horseback and donkeys come out to meet you, and people were then ferried to a base camp where journalists were gathering, which was really the Northern Alliance headquarters. And nothing was happening yet in terms of movement on the field, the battlefield. So the Americans had not yet started dropping bombs. And so people were just in a waiting position. And there was very little work in Afghanistan for people who, you know, everyone was fighting the Taliban. So there were a number of people who had college educations, who spoke some English, who were finding their way to this base camp to try and look for temporary work. So they would be paid by the day. So I actually went through a series of translators before I worked with Masood. Another journalist, Margaret Ward from Irish TV and Radio, had been working with him first. And I first, the first person I worked with was an Afghan doctor whose English was very good, but he was also extremely elitist. And when we went to interview anyone who, I mean, if we went to interview a farmer or a woman, he would say, we're not going to talk to these people because they don't have anything to say. So it was impossible, of course, to use him as a translator. And Masood, who had graduated from Kabul University with a degree in English, but had been, as he let me know, forced into being a soldier because there were no other options, always wanted to study literature, and he loved learning languages. And so he was planning to take just a couple of weeks and make a little money, but more than that, he really just wanted to keep learning. And so Margaret and I became friends, and we started working together in the field, and we shared Masood so that we could split the cost of the translator. And then when her money ran out and she left, I worked for the next 2.5 months with Masood on my own.
And it's such an extreme situation that you're describing, and one I think it's hard for anybody who hasn't done it to really understand what it means to go in a helicopter to this military outpost and then try to start working in a place that you don't know and there's a war going on. Did you feel trepidation going into this situation?
I wasn't at all scared going into the field. I mean, I'd been doing this for quite some time, and I was now working for the Washington Post. And prior to this, I had spent, you know, 10 years doing it on my own, you know, trekking in or smuggling into, you know, Tibet under martial law, Kashmir under martial law. And when I went in for the Washington Post, I had some money and I had a passport that would get me out if they needed to evacuate me. So I came in with a bit of a support system in case I got in trouble, whereas before I was always on my own. You know, it's a matter of being smart about the decisions that you make as best as you can. Finding really good fixer or a translator. In my case, I always try and get one person who can be a driver, fixer, and a translator, because the more people you have in the mix, you change it. So I'm trying to impact the scene as little as possible. And then luck, you know, the people, I think there were 17 journalists who got killed in Afghanistan in the first month. And it seems like the people who are in the greatest danger are the people who have been doing it for a really long time, and they're really experienced, and they feel like they're immortal, or young people who are rushing in with not enough humility, you know, humility about the situation, the culture, or impending death even. And then it's just a matter of you're safe until you're not. You know, some people who did everything right just hit a landmine. So I wasn't really scared going in. I was really more anxious in the way that a journalist get anxious, that, you know, you have nothing until you have the story. So that's always been there for me my whole life. So that's what I was dealing with. I knew there were a lot of factors. I didn't know. It was one of the first places I'd been reporting where I didn't speak the language at all. That was the part that had me most nervous, because I was used to knowing the language when I went into a place like China or Vietnam.
It's interesting that you say that experience in these situations can be not an advantage, because you start to become, I guess, comfortable in these extremely dangerous situations in a way.
Yeah, no, there are risks and then there are calculated risks. I know that for myself, by the time I left Afghanistan, I mean, we were in Talakan and a journalist had been killed in the middle of the night. And so everybody evacuated. And my editors were telling me, all right, they sent a chopper in to evacuate. There was one person from CBS News, the Washington Post correspondent was there at that point, and everybody evacuated, but I wouldn't leave. And, you know, at that point, I was so into the story that, and when I say into the story, what I mean by that is that, you know, you meet all these people along the way who have been through such horrendous things. You know, they've seen, you know, their families have been killed, or they've lost everything that they had materially. They've just had decades of injustice, and they still are incredibly compassionate and kind. And, you know, I think for me, just absorbing sort of that reality, their reality, and seeing how brave they still were, that for me, it was no sense of, you know, I'm the journalist and I'm here to tell the story, but rather it was that I felt like it was the least I could do. My piece of this was to tell that story for them, right? Because if it were me, I would never have been ended. I don't imagine that if I had gone through what they do, I would have been as good a person. So I just felt that why would I leave now when they were in their most dire straits? And, you know, it's just like I felt like I was witness to this extraordinary humanity, and I felt like I had to stay. It wasn't a choice. So in that situation, you know, is that a case of somebody who's too experienced and got too comfortable? I think it's a little bit different in that I was certainly aware that, you know, we all were in imminent danger, but I felt like for me, at that point in time, I was willing to risk everything to tell their story.
That was Lois Raimondo talking about her time as a journalist in Afghanistan. That essay appears in Words Matter, Writing to Make a Difference. Finally, we spoke with Ginger Hervey. Ginger will graduate next semester, but she's been working on Words Matter since the very beginning of her freshman year.
My freshman year, I got accepted to the Honors College, got accepted to MU, and my dad actually convinced me to apply for this research fellowship, and I didn't want to do it. He talked me into it, and I applied and got placed with Mary Kay Blakely, who was just a name at that point. And my first week freshman year, she took me out to lunch, and she told me about this project of an anthology, a collection of essays by people who'd graduated from the journalism school, some of the best work that the J School has produced, and she wanted to put it together. She'd been working on it for a couple years already, and it was supposed to be put out that year. I said, wow, that sounds great. I was in. Mary Kay is very convincing. And we talked about it over lunch and started working on it. So my first week, I've been working on this project since my first week freshman year. Seeing it come to fruition and actually be published and turn into this big deal, this conference that a lot of the contributors are coming in for, has been really gratifying.
What does your dad say, who convinced you to apply for that fellowship?
My dad has been right in more ways than this one about my college experience. But I think after my freshman year, I stopped being paid for this after my freshman year because MK retired. So we ended up getting some of the grant money, but my salary expired after freshman year. My fellowship expired after freshman year, and I did have a moment where I went back to my dad and was like, okay, you were right. This is the coolest thing that I've been a part of here. And it convinced me to change my major. I came in an advertising major, Stratcom, and reading these essays made me want to be a reporter. And they're really that good. And so reading these stories and reading the postscripts and realizing that at one point, these people who produced this incredible work were having the same doubts as I was, were wondering if they wanted to be reporters, that really closed the gap for me and made me realize, like, this is something I could do. It's something I want to do.
And when you read the postscripts, I mean, I think a fair amount of them talk about how hard it is to get into reporting, how hard it is to stay in it, and some of the people have left reporting and now have other jobs. Reading them, what did you think to yourself? I think it's in some ways pretty honest about how hard it is to be a reporter.
To me, that was humanizing, reading those postscripts, because reading a polished piece of journalism, especially as a freshman when I first read these, it just seemed like I would never be able to produce something like that. I remember reading over stories that I'd done in my high school newspaper and just cringing after I'd read some of these stories. And getting to read the postscripts, getting to read some of the doubts and some of the concerns that these contributors had really closed the gap between what I could do and what I am right now. And it made me realize it's okay that I'm not producing this New York Times quality stuff as a student. You're not supposed to. I know MK wrote a little bit about this in her intro, and I actually wrote about it as well in my afterword, but it's called the good taste gap. It's from Ira Glass, and he talks about how when you first get any creative field, when you first get into it, you see good work and you recognize good work, and then you look at your own work and you know that it's not good, and there's this gap between closing your own work and getting up to that good standard that's really hard, and a lot of people quit during that gap. So this really helped close that for me and helped me realize that I could get past it.
That was Ginger Hervey, a student who has been working on the book Words Matter, Writing to Make a Difference, for pretty much her entire college career. Words Matter is an anthology of journalism and essays written by Mizzou grads, mostly from the journalism school. There are also a bunch of presentations going on this week in connection with the book, and those are open to the public. There's information about those sessions at the Words Matter website. Thank you for spending your time with us here at Intersection, Conversations in Our Community. I want to thank our producers, Katie Eisterhold, George Schramm, and Christopher Baer. And of course, thank you to our guests, Mary Kay Blakely, Lois Raimondo, Shane Epping, and Ginger Hervey. Our music is Montana Skies. We also have some good news to share. Intersection will now air at our regular time, which is 6:30 on Monday evenings, and again on Wednesday mornings at 11 a.m. I'm Sarah Shariari for Intersection, right here on KBIA 91.3 FM.